Joining us today on The Enemies List is Jeff Toobin. Jeff is an author, an attorney, and has a absolutely troubling, dark, brilliant new book called Homegrown: Timothy McVeigh and the Rise of Right-Wing Extremism. And for those of you who are too young to remember Tim McVeigh, and I find myself as I approach 60 wondering how people can't know this story.
There was also maintained what was called an enemies list.
Democrats want Republicans dead.
I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody.
The women with the least likelihood of getting pregnant are the ones most worried about having abortions.
On January 6th of 2021, you had tens of thousands of people peacefully protesting.
You're the president of the United States. You can declassify just by saying it's declassified.
It's not a right-wing conspiracy theory. It's not QAnon. It's real.
I'm Rick Wilson, and this is The Enemies List. Jeff, tell us about who Tim McVeigh was, and tell us about why his attack on the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City represented a really dark turning point in what has been a rising and it has continued to rise tide of American violence on the far right.
Rick, you know, I suffer from the same issue of, you know, sometimes assuming that people are my same advanced age, which is not the case. So let's just not bury the lead. On April 19th, 1995, Timothy McVeigh set off a truck bomb outside the Alfred P. Murrah Building in Oklahoma City, and he killed 168 people, including 19 children. I think many people remember that there was a daycare center on the second floor of that building, mm-hmm. and most of the children there were killed. Most of the many people also remember that he set off the bomb because it was the second anniversary of the FBI's disastrous raid on the Waco compound of the right. Branch Davidians, where 78 people were killed. The story of Homegrown is who McVeigh is or was, and how he came to decide to bomb the Murrah Building. But just as importantly, to identify the political DNA that McVeigh represents and to demonstrate how that DNA has continued to thrive and grow, right. Including especially on January 6, 2021, when McVeigh, as I argue, attacked the Capitol.
You know, I think that part of what I found compelling about the book was it does show folks that arc. And while there was plenty of right-wing violence in America before Waco, Waco catalyzed a generation of McVeighs in a way that was at the very dawn of the penetration of the internet in terms of being a platform where people shared hate or propaganda. Tell us about how McVeigh became radicalized, the process then, and I want to compare it to how the process works today in terms of radicalization, which is much more less frictional.
Well, less frictional is well said. McVeigh came from a troubled but hardly extraordinary background outside Buffalo, New York. His father worked for 30 years at a GM plant there. His grandfather worked for 30 years at the same GM plant. And McVeigh grew up knowing that GM plant was disappearing, that the jobs in the industrial Northeast were declining, and his parents' marriage was troubled. He spent his life looking for scapegoats for why his life just went wrong. Mm-hmm. When he was still a teenager, he from the back of an ad in the National Rifle Association's magazine, he bought a novel called The Turner Diaries, this right. terribly dystopic novel about how the evil federal government had been taken over by blacks and Jews, mm-hmm. and a heroic figure named Earl Turner set off a truck bomb outside the FBI building, which right. galvanized a counter-revolution that most importantly, restored individuals' rights to bear firearms. You know, you cannot talk about Tim McVeigh's story without his obsession with gun rights and the Second Amendment. Right. After he graduated from high school, he never sort of found his feet. He worked for a security guard. He went into the army, and he was actually quite a successful soldier. He won a Bronze Star in the first Gulf War. But after the Gulf War, he failed out of Special Forces, the Green Beret training program, and his life at that point really deteriorated. That coincided with Bill Clinton's election as president, whom McVeigh focused many of his resentments on. You know, many people, as you know, I said, associate McVeigh with the Waco rage, but he was just as outraged by something that happened 6 months earlier, which was Bill Clinton signing the assault weapons ban. That gun regulation, modest as it was the final trigger that led him to try to duplicate the feat of Earl Turner in setting off a truck bomb. And if I can just, you know, add one more point, McVeigh during this period became a devoted Rush Limbaugh ditto head. And the rage that coursed through the Limbaugh broadcasts was also a motivating factor for McVeigh.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, we look at the radicalization today, and it's, you know, 99% of it's online. But back at that point, there were people like Rush Limbaugh and a bunch of these other even more insane right-wing radio talk show hosts that were out there, you know, and it was every day the blacks and the Jews are taking more of your life, your pride, your job, blah, 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 feeding that resentment. And McVeigh was exactly the demographic that made Rush Limbaugh an extraordinary success, because there were a ton of pissed off lost white boys out there who really wanted a simple, cohesive explanation for why their lives weren't great,
you know,
and why the world was changing.
One of the conventional descriptions of McVeigh over the years has been that he was anti-government and a lone wolf. Both of them are incorrect. He was not anti-government. He was anti-Bill Clinton's federal government. He was not a lone wolf. He was part of the right-wing reaction to Clinton in the mid-90s. But as you point out, the key difference between McVeigh in the 90s and his heirs today is that McVeigh, as he once said to his lawyers, "I know there's an army out there, but I couldn't find them." He didn't have the internet. He didn't have any efficient means of finding like-minded souls. He went to gun shows, which was probably the best way he could approximate a friendly group. But he didn't have the means or the charisma or the talent to recruit people. And, you know, one of the points I make in Homegrown is this was not a broader conspiracy, as some have alleged over the years. This was just Terry Nichols, his partner, and McVeigh. But he tried to do what others were able to do with the advent of the internet.
Right. And I think that, you know, the drifting around to gun shows, selling anti-government bumper stickers and tracks and Turner diary things, it seems so retro now, but it really has become, I mean, the far right, and especially the violent far right, they've become very good at activating people and very good at this sort of stochastic, constant drumbeat out there to disaffected men, mostly disaffected white men. And so you didn't need to just like, I mean, the Nichols and McVeigh relationship is always one that just, they were sort of just two sort of random drifting guys drifting through life who were not happy and had, you know, semi crappy lives. But now it's algorithmically driven. Now it's just the same thing that feeds people what they want to see, whether it's, you know, K-pop bands or boxing or cute cat videos on TikTok and other platforms. It now also feeds a generation of hundreds of thousands of white supremacists exactly the garbage they want to eat every day And it seems like they've gotten so good at it. And I don't think that either the federal government or institutions have yet built up a sort of immune response to it.
Well, Rick, you know, I agree with that. But just, you know, what prompted me to write this book at this time? You know, I covered the McVeigh and Nichols trials back in 1997. Mm-hmm. But what really sent me back to this story was October of 2020, when, as I'm sure you and many of your listeners will recall, the FBI brought down the plot to kidnap Governor Whitmer in Michigan.
Right, right.
And I started looking into that story, and those people were affiliated with the Michigan militia. I knew from covering the Oklahoma City bombing that Terry Nichols, the co-defendant, was from Michigan and was affiliated with the Michigan militia. So I said to myself, I know these people. I know what they think. But the difference is that the Whitmer plot was advanced using Facebook private chat rooms, something that McVeigh and Nichols had no access to in 1995.
They couldn't imagine it
in 1995. But it was almost a perfect distillation of what had changed and what had not changed in 25 years.
And over that arc of time, you know, we've seen, and I think in many ways, January 6th was a worse rallying cry than Waco or Ruby Ridge for a lot of these people, because now some of them have a media apparatus around them that portrays people who were engaged in what I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but I'm an act of domestic terrorism. They're now being treated as heroes. I mean, there were not a lot of people who were publicly out cheering, yay, Tim McVeigh. Now there are people who say, yeah, the guy that tried to, you know, the people that tried to storm the Capitol and kill members of Congress and kill Mike Pence, they're heroes.
Well, it is not just people who are saying this. It is the leading candidate for the Republican nomination for president, you know, who is now at his rallies playing music, you know, songs sung by January 6th convicts. Right. You know, you mentioned Waco and the symbolic resonance that Waco has had for the right wing over the decades. Where does Donald Trump hold his first rally after declaring his candidacy? It's Waco. I don't think that was a coincidence.
And, oh no, I don't think so either.
And just the normalization of violent rhetoric and violence itself is really one of the most shocking aspects of what's gone on here. I mean, and you know, look, you live this story, but you know, after January 6th, you know, there was widespread outrage, and Kevin McCarthy was outraged, and Mitch McConnell was outraged. And what we have seen over the next 2 years is, well, you know, it wasn't so outrageous after all, you know, and Donald Trump is being welcomed back into the Republican Party as its leader. And it just shows how the violence can become normalized.
I do think one of the things that, again, I wish it had fully been in the internet age, because the trial of McVeigh, which I thought, I'm a fairly well-read guy. I had not really ever paid attention to the trial and conviction of McVeigh, and the history you roll out here, it's of how the judicial system had to face up to this. Tell us about from the end of the bombing to the moment they put him on the gurney to execute him. How did that trial process through, and what does it mean for the legal system when we confront these sort of attacks and violence today?
Well, and you know, this is a very difficult problem for the legal system, because fortunately we live in a country where the First Amendment provides robust protection for the expression of views, even if they are repellent.
Sure.
And we can't have the FBI investigating every person who says something that is outside the norm. However, you know, what is clear that we need is aggressive law enforcement monitoring things like the plot to kidnap Governor Whitmer before she was kidnapped. I mean, and how to draw the line in terms of you know, investigating without disrupting First Amendment activity. I don't pretend that's an easy task. But just going to you know, your question about how this story unfolded, you know, the FBI can be justly proud of how quickly they identified McVeigh as the bomber. Just to foreshorten the story, the bomb was incredibly powerful, thousands of pounds of fertilizer and racing fuel. It projected the axle of the truck, the Ryder truck that he rented, an entire city block away. There was a vehicle identification number on the axle, which led them to a Ryder truck rental place in Junction City, Kansas, about 4 hours away. They saw that a guy named Robert Kling, fake name, rented it, but they sent agents all over Junction City, and they found that a Ryder truck renter had stayed at a motel and used the name Tim McVeigh. McVeigh had been arrested 90 minutes after the bombing for driving a car without a license. Through a weird series of screw-ups, he was not released on bail for 48 hours. During those 48 hours, almost to the minute, that's when the FBI identified that Tim McVeigh was the bomber and in custody, so he was never released from the from the little jail in Perry, Oklahoma, where he had been held on this really relatively minor charge. And that's how they caught him. But, you know, the FBI had no insight, and I frankly can't, you know, there were not many missed opportunities to catch him in advance, because there were not a lot of signs other than purchases of fuel, oil, and fertilizer, you know, which in the middle of the country,
not the weirdest thing in ag country.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, that's why they sell large quantities of fertilizer in Kansas, because people need it. There were some people who were curious about why he was trying to buy so much racing fuel without a racing car, and arguably there could have been more attention to that. But that's a lot to ask, and you know, they unfortunately, no one tipped off the FBI.
Well, I mean, and one of his associates, Michael Fortier, he was convicted for not tipping off the FBI, which I thought that was something that, I mean, I guess what did he get, like 12 years or something like that?
He did. It was not just failing to tip off the FBI. That's a very interesting subplot, the whole Michael Fortier story,
which I did not know. By the way, I mean, I knew the name, I knew something about it, but I was fascinated by.
Yeah, Timothy McVeigh, Terry Nichols, and Michael Fortier met on the first day of basic training in the Army. They stayed in touch, and Fortier was the only person that McVeigh and Nichols confided in about their plans. Now, Fortier never actually took any affirmative steps to help the conspiracy, but the moral issue about Fortier, which is deeply, deeply disturbing, is that he knew exactly what was going to happen, and he never made the single phone call, as did his wife, to the FBI to say, you got to stop this guy. Now, under American principles of law, failing to act is rarely a crime, but because he had also lied to the FBI, which is a crime, his lawyers chose to plead guilty rather than risk being in front of a jury on an extremely unsympathetic case on the facts, if not on the law, and he wound up serving about 8 or 9 years, and he's now out. He's been out for many years in the witness protection program, because he did ultimately cooperate against McVeigh and Nichols and gave very incriminating testimony.
Right. I think I think he wrote something about like that. He kind of was the linchpin in some ways, because Nichols was not exactly. I've also been curious, like, how do these? There's some weird sense of like right wing gravity that attracts these guys together. Because the three of them having all that army relationship, is something now that, you know, DHS has been warning about for a few years of there is a through line with some of these folks who are involved in right-wing violence and white supremacy, where they have a commonality of having met in the military or having had that behavior either, you know, exposed to them in the military or allowed. I mean, McVeigh was when he was in the Army, I remember reading something about, you know, he was fairly openly racist with African-American soldiers.
He was. And you know, the paradox, the difficulty with all this is that, you know, many of these commonalities are shared by thousands of otherwise law-abiding citizens. Millions of people listened to Rush Limbaugh who were not terrorists. Thousands of people served as veterans in the Army, including some with racial hostility who did not go on to be terrorists. But many terrorists have these aspects of their background in common. And how you manage that, how you come up with constitutionally permittable profiles to decide whom to investigate, you know, I don't pretend that that's an easy that's an easy issue. It's difficult.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. And I talked to a senior military official about a year and a half ago about, you know, he said, listen, Trump is gone, but there was a tone in a lot of the enlisted troops that, you know, sort of permitted that in the Trump era. There was a sort of like, now we can say what we want to say. And a lot of these people were, you know, from the demographic, from the part of the country, the McVeigh, that disaffected part of the country. And it, you know, it's honestly an insult to the military service of 99.999% of the people who serve that these folks have ended up giving a sense of empowerment to some of these people who would say, well, my service lets me be what I want to be. I was there to defend the white race. No, pal, you were there to defend the Constitution.
Right. Well, and you know, one of the things that, you know, I tried to, you know, be very careful about is just that point. You don't want to disparage veterans, you know, who serve their country in overwhelming numbers. But it is true that there is a disproportionate number of these extremists who are veterans. And, you know, one of the questions that I asked, and I didn't, you know, you couldn't get a perfect answer to it. Does the Army radicalize these people, or are the people who are predisposed this way attracted to the Army and go to the Army because they get to shoot guns all the time? And the answer is there's some of both. But again, it's very hard to evaluate that in advance.
Yeah, there's a certain overlap in those right. two circles in the Venn diagram, obviously. So tell us a little bit more about the trial of McVeigh and the fact that the federal government, which is, they very rarely seek the death penalty in the federal government. I mean, it is extraordinarily uncommon.
Well, and also what makes McVeigh's trial particularly interesting and relevant is who was the Justice Department official in charge of it. It was Merrick Garland, was a sort of an upper mid-level political appointee in the Clinton administration, mm-hmm. who was assigned to supervise the trial. You know, again, it's hard to keep track of events of relatively recent history to know what was going on in the same time. The bombing was April 19th, 1995. January 1995 was the start of O.J. Simpson's criminal trial. And Garland was deeply offended by the celebrity circus that the O.J. Simpson case became. And that mm-hmm. prompted him to create a trial and an investigation that was very, as much low profile as possible. The lawyers did not become famous. There were not many press conferences. There were not many attempts to call attention to the broader political context of the case. And I think, you know, Garland and the trial team led by an Illinois lawyer named Joe Hartzler did a very effective job of showing that Tim McVeigh and later Terry Nichols were the people who assembled and set off this bomb, but they did not make an effort to put the case into a broader political context. The person who tried to do that was Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton gave a series of very prescient speeches about the dangers of the militia. One of the most interesting things I did in reporting Homegrown was interview Bill Clinton, who I had been told in the Oval Office on the day of the bombing said, you know, this was not Islamic terrorists. This was the militias. And I said, how did you know that? How could you just assume that? And he said, because I dealt with them for 12 years in Arkansas. And he gave me chapter and verse, which I had no idea about, with his experience. Oh, yeah. But Garland tried the case a very different way. Garland wanted the case as narrow as possible, as press averse as possible. And I think while that was understandable in the Oklahoma City context, that is a more questionable way to run the Justice Department when you're Attorney General, when there is this huge threat of right-wing extremism and anti-democratic activity that he has been relatively quiet about in the bully pulpit of the Attorney General job.
I think that there is a desire on some of the right-wing militia types. There are some of them who want to be martyrs. There are some of them who want to be targeted. They want to be, while they love their freedom on paper, there's a streak of them. And I've had some dealings with some idiot far right militia types in Florida. And when the head of it got sent to jail, he was proud of it. He loved it. He thought that was the best thing for his credibility that had ever happened. Oh, I'll do my 7 years and I'll be blah, blah. It's the weird incentives of the modern social media and right-wing media environment make some of these people feel like that they're almost heroic.
Yeah, but Rick, I mean, the thing that always baffles me, and again, this is where you have to live your life. You have decided to live your life is there are now 1,000 people who have been prosecuted for January 6th. Mm-hmm. The one who has not been prosecuted is the guy who inspired it all.
Nothing makes my head explode more than this.
Well,
Jeff.
And nothing. I mean, I can understand why it makes your head explode, but how do those 1,000 people feel? I mean, that's the thing that is so peculiar to me, because as far as I can tell, there has not been a great backlash against Trump for the fact that, you know, these people will either go to prison or have felony records, or, you know, it is not a small thing to be convicted of federal crimes. And 1,000 people are going to have this on their, you know, carry this around for the rest of their lives, yet they are still cheering for the guy who has at least so far gotten away scot-free. It's baffling to me.
I had a conversation with an intelligence official who said to me, who is a deeply knowledgeable intelligence official. We were talking about this about a year ago, and he said, jihadis don't expect the emir to put on the bomb vest.
I guess.
And the parallel to it, the parallel to it was so hard and striking. I said, oh my God, that's it. I mean, it's the same sort of weirdly cultural, cult-like adoration of the dear leader that, you know, they didn't expect Trump to go to jail. Now, you know, he should. I don't think he will, but because I've just seen the guy have the luck of the devil over and over again. But it is a fascinating sort of moment in our political culture where we have 1,000+ people now, and DOJ seems to now be, you know, moving that ball down the field pretty aggressively, right? Do you think there's going to be any kind of deterrent effect with this?
Well, I think some people, I have read some, you know, my book is about the Oklahoma City bombing. It's not really, I have a lengthy epilogue about, the events, including January 6th. You know, I do think, there are people who got swept up in this, who regret it and whose families regret it. So, you know, I think it will deter some, but with the continuing popularity of Donald Trump in the Republican Party, it obviously has not deterred everyone.
Clearly not sufficiently.
No, that remains one of the many mysteries of the Trump era.
Indeed. Well, Jeffrey Toobin, thank you so very much for joining me today on the Enemies List podcast. Folks, the book is called Homegrown, Timothy McVeigh and the Rise of Right-Wing Extremism. I encourage you to read it. It is a granular examination of what was really one of the seminal moments in the rise of violent right-wing extremism in this country. And it deserves it deserves a look. So Jeff, once again, thank you for coming on the program. And I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Cheers. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you, sir. Today's entry on the Enemies List is Kaylee Campbell Layton. I promise you, until today, I had certainly never heard of her, and you probably haven't either. But Kaylee Campbell Layton is a member of Moms for Liberty. And yesterday, she posted on social media the following. Biden left many military service dogs to die in Kabul after the evacuation. I'm calling for the public execution of this old man, and you can't change my mind. I hope I make the little FBI man in my phone proud. Look, politics is filled with metaphor, and military metaphor and aphorisms all the time. We're going to nuke this guy. We're going to take him out. We're going to put a bullet in this guy. Those are metaphors. Here's one of these people who now feels empowered because the movement of MAGA and Moms for Liberty and its entire sphere around it has diminished the legitimacy in their minds of the presidency of the United States. So they don't mind calling for his death. They don't mind calling for the execution of this old man. And you can't change my mind. I know, Kaylee, we can't change your mind. I've looked at your Instagram feed. It was a rabbit hole from hell, folks. If you look it up, you will find she's one of the people that goes into Target and screams about the gays. But Kaylee, while we can't change your mind, we can put you on the enemies list. Get your shit together. This has been the Enemies List. And if you've been enraged or engaged or enlivened by this week's episode, let's do something about it. This podcast is part of Resolute Square, a new front in the war to preserve democracy. We were looking for a place to fight back against the MAGA media, and this is it. In addition to this podcast and many others, each week, Resolute Square members will sit down with me and other founders for an intimate meeting of the minds, talking about what's really going on behind the curtain of American politics and analyzing the minds and the motivations of the people that are shaping this country's future, good and bad, along with exclusive analysis and insight from our newsletters, which are anything but conventional wisdom. And yes, we'll also have merch to make the MAGA heads in your life furious, and more. Become a partner in this fight at resolutesquare.com/enemies. And folks, if you could like, subscribe, and rate the podcast, I would be enormously grateful. And I cannot tell you how grateful and how heartfelt your support has been for this podcast and for these conversations. And we look forward to many, many more. Thanks again. And remember, whatever you do, stay off the list.